You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It's clear by now that the collapse of the subprime mortgage industry was one of the major contributing factors leading to the current economic crisis. In Our Lot, How Real Estate Came to Own Us, journalist Elisa Katz takes us deep into the history of American homeownership to explore exactly how we went from the real estate ecstasy of the 1990s and early 2000s to the agonies of 2008. Elisa Katz teaches journalism at New York University and works as an editorial consultant with the Pratt Center for Community Development. Her book is published by Bloomsbury, and I'm very pleased it has brought her to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
When did mortgages become the norm for home buyers?
Well, they became the norm for home buyers pretty early in the 20th century. Until 1910s, 1920s, the idea of borrowing for a home or borrowing a substantial money at all was really looked down upon as being unthrifty and somehow sinful. Generally, buyers just paid cash or built their own homes.
But you say until the 20s, and then the Great Depression comes at the end of the 20s. So had mortgages become popular? Were they one of the causes for the Great Depression?
Mortgages were certainly one of the causes for the Depression. Home buying and real estate development just became enormously popular in the 1920s. And mortgages then were really different than the ones we take for granted now. They only ran for about 3 years or 5 years or seven. They also required a pretty large down payment. And then they would basically, at the end of that five-year period, the homeowner would have to refinance the mortgage and was paying interest only the entire time. So if you could get another bank to lend you a second mortgage, that would be great. But generally, people couldn't once the Depression hit.
So the answer was, at least in theory, that you either paid for it in that first, paying off the first mortgage and owned it, or you had trouble.
Yes, exactly. Basically, homeowners were borrowers indefinitely as they kept paying off the interest. And when banks couldn't make new mortgages and homeowners had borrowed more than their homes were worth, then they were stuck.
But we are generally talking about middle-class people engaged in this process, aren't we?
Right. I mean, it was basically people who could put down that 50% down payment, had some money already. The idea that someone who had a modest budget could become a homeowner with very little money down was really something very new that happened after the Great Depression.
What about people of color? Would they have been able to get a mortgage as easily, even if they had the money?
But most definitely not. I mean, for most of the 20th century, both private bankers and the government actively discriminated against people of color by refusing to make mortgages in vast parts of major cities.
So redlining. That you say that was government was complicit, or was government actually active in doing that?
I mean, government was both complicit and also really led the way through the agencies that came to support the mortgage market. I mean, after the Great Depression, you saw the government play a really large role with the Federal Housing Administration insuring mortgages, but only in those neighborhoods that they felt were safe and worthy for their investments. And they would just literally draw lines around entire parts of cities and say, we will not lend here.
And I suspect we're still seeing the result of that in our urban landscape across this country today.
Certainly. No, I mean, the effects of redlining are very much with us and have been compounded by what we can call reverse redlining, right? You had a period of decades where lenders and the government programs that supported them would systematically discriminate by withholding credit. And then what you began to see in the early 1980s was a big reversal where lenders and financial companies figured out how to offer credit to people in areas that had been denied, but on very, very problematic terms. It's what we now know as subprime lending.
So poor people could now also live the American dream and not be discriminated against. But they paid a price.
They paid a very big price.
When did the structure of the modern housing market begin to emerge? Wouldn't you say that the 1950s with the move to the suburbs was a key factor?
Well, yeah, I mean, the move to the suburbs didn't happen spontaneously. I mentioned the Federal Housing Administration. This was a really revolutionary government program, right? The FDR in the 1930s committed the federal government to insuring mortgages for every GI who came home from the war, as well as any home buyer if they were willing to and able to move to one of these new suburbs, which were very often whites only. And so what you had then was just a massive growth in the home ownership rate nationally.
Did that counteract the desire of many to want to live in the middle of a city where all the action was?
Right. No, I mean, what the FHA insurance did was it made it cheaper to live, much cheaper to live in the suburbs in a nice home that you could own
than
in
the
city if you were white and a bank would lend to you. And on top of that, what you had was a real estate agents actively encouraging white homeowners in cities to leave through a phenomenon known as blockbusting, scaring them that their neighborhoods were changing.
And that affected the neighborhoods that they left behind.
It was a huge drain of population that affected cities across the country.
My guest is Elisa Katz. Her book, Our Lot, How Real Estate Came to Own Us, it's published by Bloomsbury. You talked to Gail Sincotta, a civilian political activist who started protesting realtors' strategies in Chicago in the 1970s. What was she fighting for?
Well, I did not. I wish I had been able to talk to Gail Sincotta. Gail, in fact, died in 2001, unfortunately. So my account of Gail Sincotta was reconstructed out of historical documents and interviewing many, many people who knew her. Gail
I should
really
have said you wrote about Gail Sincotta.
Yes, right. So Gail, she was a Chicago mother of six who in the 1960s first got involved in school issues there. And very quickly that led her to dealing with what we were just talking about, with a massive white flight out of neighborhoods and really predatory real estate investing that was going on in those communities, and figuring out how can we stop the destruction of our neighborhoods.
But Chicago also has a reputation for being one of the most segregated cities in the North, to the point where Martin Luther King Jr. actually came to Chicago to talk about integrating it. So a direct result of this?
Well, it was very very closely related, right? Because segregation in Chicago was very much a product of wholesale discrimination by landlords and the lack of access to credit for African Americans that led to many black Chicagoans becoming contract buyers, basically renting to own from their landlords under very, very exploitative terms. And that was one of the forces that was leading to downward spirals for both the homeowners or borrowers in neighborhoods that Gail was really trying to fight.
When Fannie Mae was created, what did it was it complicit in this kind of thing, or was it working against it?
Well, Fannie Mae was very complicit for almost all of its history. And Fannie Mae was a part of this Great Depression intervention into building home ownership for a large number of Americans. And it was a government agency for many years, and like the Federal Housing Administration, put its resources into white suburban home ownership. In 1968, Fannie Mae became a private shareholder-owned company, although with government oversight, and it continued to systematically discriminate. And one thing that Gail Sincotta and many other urban activists were trying to do in the 1970s and 80s was to ask Fannie Mae, as a government-sponsored institution, to make its resources available without discrimination.
For decades, politicians have been stressing the benefits of home ownership, claiming that it creates better citizens. Is there any real proof that it creates better citizens?
Yeah, I mean, this is a really consistent theme throughout the history of government advocacy for home ownership, and has very often been kind of political claim. There is some evidence of it, right? We've had a very large body at this point of social science research looking at what differentiates homeowners from the rest of us.
Well, there's a sense of community that they would have.
There's a sense of community. There's more, what you generally see is more involvement in political affairs locally, PTAs, things like that. And that's not surprising given that they have an investment to protect. But what was very interesting is that many of the government policies promoting home ownership came before the research was actually done, and it was only once the research came out that it became clear that, in fact, homeowners and renters really are not all that different.
So why did President Clinton, for example, feel that he had to come up with policies that would allow 80% of Americans to become homeowners?
His policies did to have 80% of Americans become homeowners. I think Clinton was really looking for what he would call a win-win between what was good for business and industry and what was what would be a sort of helpful social policy. And I think it, rather by accident, first campaign and then presidency really identified home ownership as a way to both improve individual households' economic position, but then also keep the economy moving and produce economic activity.
Well, after talking to bankers, brokers, and homeowners, you come to the conclusion that it was the policies, not just of Bill Clinton, but of three presidents that really have led us into this mess as much as anything.
Right.
More than Wall Street?
Well, I mean, Wall Street clearly is ultimately who's accountable. But look, my attitude in going into this book, right, is that, of course, Wall Street is going to seek to make as much money as it can and advance its interests. That's its job. And it's the job of government to really determine social and economic policies that work for the greater good. So that's really why I focused on the role of different administrations in promoting ownership. And I think the political—
Well, we're talking about liberals and conservatives, or at least in theory, liberals and conservatives.
No, homeowners. Ownership is really the one social investment that liberals and conservatives, Democrats and Republicans have historically agreed is a good thing and been willing to put political capital and substantial government money into.
So when we started seeing the subprime rate mortgages, is that because government wanted to see more people who couldn't get mortgages in the past get them?
Well, I think the only thing that quote, government wanted to do at that point, this is in the 1980s when the major deregulation took place that allowed subprime to exist. They wanted to deregulate the mortgage markets to allow more capital to come in from different sources. And the stated reason at the time was, yes, that this would be a good way to widen the reach of who could become a homeowner. But I think the argument more often was it would also just simply make mortgages more affordable and that it would just allow the U.S. to sort of maintain the number of homeowners that it already had.
And I would think that for some people it was a good thing. People who couldn't have gotten homes otherwise in the past because of either racism or other issues wound up having homes and probably still have them to this day.
Right. No doubt. And in fact, the government policies were explicitly designed to address this legacy of discrimination, which was a serious problem that did need addressing. What I look at in the book is really this turning point where did that project of civil rights and trying to finish this great historic project of home ownership for all, where did it go wrong? Where did it go from being an empowering phenomenon to becoming the subprime monster?
My guest is Alisa Katz, and she teaches journalism at New York University, works as an editorial consultant at the Pratt Center for Community Development, formerly editor of City Limits, a magazine about New York City and its neighborhoods, currently writing for any number of magazines like Mother Jones, New York, Big Money. And she has a book called Our Lot, How Real Estate Came to Own Us, published by Bloomsbury. We'll continue after this. We're back with Alisa Katz, her book, Our Lot, How Real Estate Came to Own Us, published by Bloomsbury. Do we know who came up with the idea of bundling individual mortgages and selling them as securities?
Yeah, I mean, I wish I knew who originally came up with the idea. Some government bureaucrat in 1970 first did it. But the first person to really do it on Wall Street on any scale was someone named Louis Ranieri, who was immortalized in a fantastic book called Liar's Poker by Michael Lewis. And Ranieri realized that the mortgage business was huge. And he worked for Salomon Brothers at the time and had a thriving business in trading securities that were issued by the government, and then Salomon would merely sell them. And Ranieri and other folks thought, well, why can't we do this?
Who was buying mortgage-backed securities at first?
At first, it was insurance companies and other institutional investors. But
people who you would think would know better.
Well,
was this a good investment at the time?
It was a very good investment at the time because these securities were very carefully vetted and packaged and were done on a very small scale because they were pretty much illegal under most circumstances at the time. It took a lot of regulatory reform to allow mortgage-backed securities to exist the way that we know them today.
When you say reform, you mean deregulation.
That's right. Deregulation, following the Great Depression, we have to remember that in the 1920s, there had been a booming business in mortgage-backed securities back then, too, on apartment buildings. And one of the big changes following the Great Depression was a prohibition on securities like that, both at the federal level and at the state level. So it actually required the Congress and the Reagan White House to really go back and throw out a large part of what the Congress and FDR had done in the 30s.
So if these bundled mortgages were performing well, how did we wind up with the subprime mortgage?
Yeah, well, it took a lot of work and mistakes over a couple of decades. But look, subprime emerged when the investment banks that now, thanks to deregulation, could begin to get into the mortgage-backed securities business started looking around and saying, well, what can we do to make money? Who is not being served in the mortgage marketplace? And one of the biggest openings was people with bad credit who could get a mortgage and were not going to be a risk if they paid a high enough interest rate, high enough fees, and other penalties.
So actually they were paying more for the house than somebody else might have.
Paying much, much more. And in fact, some of the early subprime lenders were charging interest upwards of 14%.
And why were people willing to accept such huge loans? Because there are people out there who blame the borrowers. Buyer beware. Did they just assume that real estate values would continue rising indefinitely?
Well, the early subprime loans very often were home improvement loans or refinances of existing fixed rate or FHA or other mortgages that were a lot safer. And so what you had was this new phenomenon of mortgage brokers, these independent agents who would go out into low and moderate income communities, knocking on doors or making phone calls and saying, hey, you need money to fix your roof? Well, we can help you out.
In 2006, you published a story in Mother Jones about the collapse of the real estate market in certain neighborhoods in Cleveland. Was that an early example of the crisis that the entire nation would eventually face?
It was a stark example of the crisis, and I was amazed. One reason I went there for Mother Jones in 2006 was that the story really wasn't being covered outside of Ohio, and this was at a time when the real estate boom was booming. Prices were at record highs.
But weren't bankers paying attention, assuming that if it happened in Cleveland, it could easily happen elsewhere?
They had all kinds of excuses and rationalizations for why Cleveland was the exception, because unemployment was high, because the city and others in Ohio were depopulating. But they didn't have to worry that Cleveland was full of foreclosures, because when you mix thousands of mortgages into mortgage-backed securities, if 5% or fewer fail, the investors still get paid.
You also visited housing developments in California and Florida, where places have stopped being built. You could just as easily have gone to Greenpoint in Williamsburg, couldn't you?
I could have, and I have in subsequent articles that I've done. No, I mean, look, the nation is now littered with huge surpluses of unneeded, often luxury housing, because the funding was both there for the potential buyers to purchase the units, but also for the developers to just create massive projects for which there was no demand.
And there are any number of what one would assume would be prime housing developments sitting empty. There's one on Grand Army Plaza designed by a very famous architect. And every time I go by, I look to see how many of the apartments have been bought, and it's very few.
Yeah, I mean, New Yorkers are really wondering what's going to happen to all these buildings. And, the developers are praying for time in many cases. They have reserve funds that they can draw on, and many of them will last until next year.
Now, many people have suggested that we go back, we tighten up regulations. The Times ran a story about how bankers will start giving most of their campaign contributions to Republican candidates if the Obama administration and Congress, the Democrats in Congress, are serious about re-regulating.
Right. Well, I think that the what Wall Street is really concerned about right now, whatever is left of Wall Street, is the idea of regulations that really constrain the kinds of products they can put out there, what they're actually allowed to do in the buying and selling of mortgages. But you know, those changes really need to happen. Without things like the Consumer Financial Protection Agency, we are going to just see history repeat itself very, very soon.
A listener, Andrew in Manhattan, would like you to comment on variable rate mortgages.
Well, you know, these were not even legal until the early 1980s when Congress made it so. And you know, since then, what you have had is basically an inversion of the whole business model of how mortgages are made. It used to be that the lender would take on the risk of interest rates changing and possibly losing money because of that. It became really common in the 90s and 2000s for borrowers to take on that risk.
So what's going to happen to that goal of a home for everyone?
That is the big question right now. My big fear at the moment is that, in fact, the backlash and the pendulum swing in the other direction is going to go too far. We're really at real risk of losing the many positive accomplishments of his legacy of widespread government-supported home ownership, which simply, you know, is simply impossible for most working people to own a home unless there's help from the government.
Well, somebody can rent those places, and at least some money can be generated. Wouldn't that be a good solution?
For the homeowners to rent instead? If renting were a more tolerable state of affairs, it might be a good solution. I think we in New York tend to forget that we've got a pretty decent system of rent regulation, and you know, but that is not the case for most tenants in the U.S. Most tenants live in a very precarious situation and have very few rights.
Alyssa Katz's book is called Our Lot, How Real Estate Came to Own Us. It's published by Bloomsbury. She teaches journalism at New York University, works as an editorial consultant with Pratt Center for Community Development, and is also associated with housingwatch.com. The book is did I say it was published by Bloomsbury?
Yes, you
Let's
did.
Say it again. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.